Hi, I'm Kathy Forsty, music director at Casey Cafe Radio. Today I have the pleasure of chatting with banjo gal Donna Lynn Caskey. Donna's newest album, The Love Still Shows, has quickly become a Casey Cafe Radio favorite. The 11 original songs by this clawhammer banjo player are timeless yet topical. Her songs lift the spirit and touch the heart. Thanks, Donna Lynn Caskey, for joining us today on Casey Cafe Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It's interesting that you play banjo. Why did you decide to use banjo as a singer-songwriter?
Well, the banjo kind of picked me. I started playing in 2001, but I'd been bit by the banjo bug before that. I grew up in Virginia, on the coast of Virginia. Actually, it turns out that where I grew up is kind of near the first historical documented places of banjo in this country, since it is originally an African instrument. But I really got bit by the banjo bug when I attended college in Appalachia in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. And I just really fell in love with the sound and the music. And I bought myself a banjo for a graduation present. And I had always written like poetry, or I would always like to write. So about 3 months into learning to play banjo in earnest, I started writing songs. So it kind of happened organically from there. But, you know, I feel like the banjo picked me more than I decided, like, hey, I'm going to pick a banjo and I'm going to start writing songs. One thing just kind of led to another.
I know myself, I'm like a very rudimentary banjo player. And I've tried several times. I played it when I was like a teenager, and then I gave it up for a long time. And recently, since I started teaching, you know, I'll do banjo lessons a little bit at where I work. To me, banjo is like the hardest of all the string instruments to play. I'm always flabbergasted by people who say, I just want to learn how to play the banjo. And I'm like, okay, you know what you're in for here.
And it's funny to me, I mean, people who play guitar blow my mind. I play a little bit of guitar, but I'm like, wow, this is six really thick strings, you know?
Yeah.
Where people wonder, I do a lot of different old time type banjo tunings because I started by playing old time music, and you know, people are like, oh, how do you deal with all those banjo tunings? And I was like, well, that's what I know how to do. I guess it's easy what calls to you and what you pick up and stick with.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, like, when I first started teaching, I was reading a book by Earl Scruggs, and basically, you know, he says you can't let the right hand know what the left hand's doing when you play the banjo. So I thought that was an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, and then actually, I know when I've taught some, you know, a lot of people get really focused on, for most players, right-handed players, you know, trying to figure out the chords with the left hand. And, you know, it's like, you'll get that. The main thing is to kind of get the rhythm in the right hand, because you're playing a drum with strings. And that's a lot of what the right hand technique. I play clawhammer style, not so much Earl Scruggs style. But I think in any style, a lot of it is getting that rhythm in the right hand.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you explain to our listeners what clawhammer style is?
So I don't wear metal finger picks. It's a percussive style. Like I said, the banjo has its roots in African instruments, and clawhammer style is believed to have roots in more African styles of playing. Actually, it was amazing. I saw Ngoni players, and it was really moving to me. Ngoni is an African instrument, one of the ancestor instruments of the banjo. And, you know, to see people play where they're striking down with their fingernail and kind of striking the head of the instrument like a drum is very akin to how I play clawhammer. So, yeah, I'm actually striking down on the string with my index fingernail and then playing the fifth string, the shorter string that gives the banjo its ringing banjo sound with my thumb. So it's sort of a percussive sound without finger picks. I'm using my fingernails and my hand, and it is a percussive style.
Yeah, very cool. How did you get the name Banjo Gal?
Actually, it's funny. When I first started playing in earnest, well, I moved to California in 2001, and I really started playing banjo just a couple weeks before I left. I was going to consign the banjo. Like I said, I'd bought it for myself as a graduation present from college, but then I worked a lot of jobs and kind of moved around a lot and was trying to get my feet, and I felt bad. It's like, here I have this beautiful instrument, and I'm not learning how to play it, so maybe I'm best to consign it. But then I ended up paying the woman to fix it up instead. She's like, you don't want to sell your banjo. And then I ended up getting a scholarship to the John C. Campbell Folk School in North Carolina for a beginning clawhammer banjo class by ear. So I did that just a couple of weeks before I moved to California. But when I came to California, I didn't have a car. You know, I'd walk around with a banjo. I'd walk to this old-time jam in town that I just stumbled into my very first week in town from some players at the farmer's market. And I don't know, I distinctly remember, you know, people on the street, other street musicians, hey, banjo gal, because I'd be walking around with this banjo. So I guess it kind of grew from there.
Yeah.
Or just as an identifying feature, you know, that gal who's walking around with a banjo.
That's cool. People know you by your banjo.
Yeah. Hey, it works. They're kind of like a honing device in a way, you know, where the banjo world is a small world in a way, you know, a lot of us know each other, connected, or it attracts attention. You know, people tend to not have neutral feelings about the banjo. People tend to love it or less than love it, shall we say.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it does have that kind of lightning rod tendency, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. I know there's a lot of jokes about banjos and that sort of thing. So
there are. I do my bit. Well, I don't know. The ones that are kind of lighthearted and good fun, or I do my part to try to, you know, turn them around somehow. Oh, what you really meant was.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much you love this, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Gotta have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, banjo is one of those instruments that it's usually associated with being happy, you know? But I mean, I think there's some really great melancholy kind of songs that can be played on the banjo. I mean, your music is an example of that. There's not just, you know, happy banjo music. It's really can bring some depth and meaning into songs, and especially the way you play it. It's a pretty versatile instrument when you really have somebody who knows what they're doing on it.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because too, I mean, well, I mean, of course, banjos make me happy. And even when I play a mournful song or when I play, I mean, it feels good to play it. But a lot of music that really sort of influenced me and inspired me, true, you know, they were the happy sort of square dance songs or jigs, but also really kind of mournful ballads from the mountains, you know, where people were accompanying themselves with banjo, you know, more just to accompany themselves singing as opposed to a more band dance style, which is fun. But, you know, like you said, I think the banjo has a lot of range that it doesn't always get credit for.
So you just mentioned music you listen to. So what types of music are in your background do you think that kind of contributed to your style?
Oh boy. I mean, you know, there's that sort of generic thing. Everything I've ever heard, I mean, I'm sure has flavored me in some way, just being a lifelong lover of music in general. Like I said, I did grow up in Virginia. I'm the youngest of 10 kids. My maternal granny, she sang unaccompanied ballads. She knew a lot of the music, you know, old music from Virginia growing up. My mom was a singer and really loved music. And a lot of my siblings are very musical. And even one of my sisters is a music therapist. So I did grow up immersed in a lot of different kinds of music, including popular music when I was growing up, or things that my siblings liked and introduced me to. So that was kind of interesting, you know, a mix of traditional music, traditional folk music from this country that, of course, had roots elsewhere. And then also a lot of singer-songwriter music, rock and roll, even world music. But in terms of what kind of really inspired me on the banjo way, I mean, yes, one of my sisters plays fiddle. Another brother of mine, you know, did play some banjo when I was growing up. So it wasn't totally foreign to me. I'd heard it growing up. But then, like I said, when I went to college in the mountains, really getting into, you know, Mike Seeger in particular, I remember seeing him live and him really emphasizing that folk music belongs to folks. It belongs to everybody. He made it very accessible. It was amazing to me, you know, that he played as many instruments and styles as he played by ear. At that time, I'd kind of been like, well, I really love music, but I'd taken some piano lessons and I had a really hard time reading music notation. You know, so I was like, oh, well, as much as I love this, maybe it's not for me, you know, even though I love it, maybe it's not something for me to do since I can't read music very well, or I tended to be pretty shy. So this idea that folk music was for anybody and that anybody could make some music and that, you know, oh, if you can pick out a melody by ear, I know that was a major influence in me feeling like, okay, this appreciation I'm having for the banjo, like maybe I could make some music.
So who were your early musical influences, not just for banjo, but just music that you liked to listen to growing up?
Oh boy. Well, I mean, thinking back, I mean, kind of a funny mix of just things around the house. I mean, I remember, you know, of course, Peter, Paul and Mary records and things my siblings were listening to, you know, everything from the Beatles to U2 to... So it was kind of a mix of rock and singers, Patti Smith even, you know, I know one of my sisters, big Patti Smith fan, you know, like, oh yeah, normal taste for a young kid at that age. Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Judy Collins, you know, that kind of stuff were things I would hear around the house growing up, and, you know, where I would listen to the records myself, even though they weren't my records. Or I remember my sisters getting after me, like, give me that back. That's mine.
Were all your siblings like musical? Where did you fall in line with what number are you in the 10 kids?
Well, that's the thing. I am the youngest.
Oh, wow.
And there's actually about a 10-year gap between me and my youngest sister.
Okay.
So my brothers, I have two brothers and they're the oldest. So they'd actually moved out by the time I was born.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the experience of when I was born, it was like a very full house still. But, you know, by the time I was about 8 or 9 years old, everybody had moved out.
Right.
So they were teenagers and young adults for the most part when I showed up. My youngest sister was 9, but, you know, it wasn't long before they're all teenagers and moving out and busy with their own things, but all definitely involved in music. My sisters, let's see. Actually, yeah, my youngest four sisters, like, they were all involved in orchestra and band. So I have sisters who are twins. One played violin. Well, she plays violin. One plays viola and various instruments. And so it was around. And then when my brothers would come visit, like I said, one of my brothers played some banjo and fiddle and guitar. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, music was not a foreign substance.
Right. Music, especially, I mean, I have a very similar situation, too. In my family, I'm one of 9. I'm the youngest of 9. And
you get it.
Yeah, and there's a 15-year difference between me and my next sibling. I have, like, a sister that's 25 years older than me.
Like my brother.
Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, I was an aunt before I was born. I was a great-aunt by the time I was 13. I was a great-great-aunt by the time I was 35. So, you know, I think when you're in that situation where you're not really an only child, but you feel like you're an only child sometimes in that situation, you kind of turn to things that kind of fill up your home, you know? And so for me, it was music too. I mean, I was really into music and listening to everything and trying to play every instrument I could, you know? So.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you get it. So do you get it? Are you still like the baby to this day? Because I'm like, how old am I? How old before I retire from being
exactly?
The baby?
I'll always be. They always look at me like, oh, you don't know anything, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
in a sense, or having a lot of extra parents in a way. Some of my sisters were more like extra mothers than mm-hmm. I mean, my poor mother, of course, was exhausted by the time I showed up.
Yeah,
right. Probably over it in hindsight, you know, like surprise.
There's a little bit of resentment, I think, because I got things that they didn't get because my parents, they didn't have 8 other kids in the house or whatever when I came along.
Exactly. But like everything, there were trade-offs too. I definitely had a different growing up experience, I would say, than my siblings did. Especially, well, my dad had retired from the Navy by the time I was born too. So, you know, some of my siblings had the experience of moving around a lot, or some of them were born in California and some were born in Hawaii. Whereas I'd stayed in the same house my whole growing up, you know, because he'd retired from that by the time I showed up. So.
Yeah, me too. My parents moved around a lot before I came along, and I grew up basically from the time I was 2 until I was, you know, left home in the same home. So, yep, and everybody else moved around. So, was banjo something even back then? Was something you were interested in playing, even as a kid?
Not really. I mean, I think it really came onto my radar when I was a teenager. But not even to play it. I just know that I got kind of more into music with a twang, so to speak, as a teen, in addition to sort of the different like rock and pop and folk I was listening to, where I did start listening to more bluegrass or singer-songwriters from around the South where I was from, who occasionally did incorporate banjo into their instrumentation. But like I said, yeah, I didn't really fall for the banjo until I was an adult. I was in college. I was a member of the Roanoke Fiddle and Banjo Club, where I went to college in Roanoke, Virginia. And, you know, I would drag my friends from the dorm, like, come, this is so cool. You know, they had showcases with different bluegrass and old time bands. And if people really liked the music, they'd hop up on stage and start flat foot dancing, and they'd have these clogging troops. And it was just fantastic. And I would get weepy with joy when the banjo played. So that was really, it caught my attention, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you get your degree in?
Actually, visual art. So kind of like you mentioned, growing up as an only child, in a sense, who wasn't an only child in a way, since I was so much younger than my siblings. And you know, there was some degree of chaos that went in the home while I was growing up, especially when there were family gatherings. But whereas I was kind of content to be reading a book or off in a corner writing by myself or drawing a picture. So it was the arts in general, including music, that really spoke to me, like writing, visual art, and music. And, you know, whereas as a kid, I got this notion in my head that even though I love music, I'm not good at it. I did really have a knack for drawing, and I got a lot of recognition in school for my artwork. And I actually ended up going to college with significant art scholarships for fine art. But that said, I was the type of person who was interested in a lot of things. So I made the choice. I had the opportunity to either go to like an art and design college or do liberal arts. And I chose to go the liberal arts route because as much as I loved to draw, and it was very meditative for me, still is working on visual projects. You know, I just liked learning about all kinds of things. So that's part of how I ended up where I ended up. Also, the college I went to, it had a strong writing program. So I also really liked to write a lot. So that was an appeal of that particular school as well. Little did I know I would eventually become a songwriter. There it is.
Yeah. Kind of goes hand in hand, really.
Creative process. You know, to me, it kind of doesn't matter the medium, you know.
Right.
They all kind of blend into each other.
Yeah, being an artist is, you know, I think a very broad term as far as the different mediums you can work in. So how did you get from Virginia to Ventura, California?
Well, very literally by train. Uh-huh. But I actually lived up in Santa Barbara the first year I was in California. I actually did one semester of grad school out here to go with my very lucrative liberal arts degree. There was a program in something called Mythological Studies nearby that appealed to me, that was about world religions and psychology and storytelling and art and creative process, which are all things I'm interested in very much. So that particular graduate program, I call it the bait that got me out here, because I did one semester and it was beautiful and I don't regret it, but it was really cutting into my time learning to play banjo when I got here. And then when I did come out here, it was almost like this life was waiting for me. As I mentioned, you know, the very first week I was in town, you know, wandering around town with my banjo. I think the very first day I was in town, I met a fiddler at the farmer's market, and I'm in touch with him to this day. You know, he's like, hey, there's this old time jam, you know, under this tree at a park every Wednesday, come, you know. So I fell in with this group of musicians, and, you know, that was 2001. 16 years later, I'm in touch with a lot of those people. Not long after that, where I happened to live in the Santa Barbara, Goleta area in California, there happened to be like an old time banjo and fiddle festival and contest. That was the first place I played banjo solo in public and sang solo as an adult. Because as much as I like to sing, I was very shy about it. And I don't say this is a bragging thing. It was actually very, very good timing for that to happen at that point. It was the first place I played banjo solo in public and the first time I sang solo in public, and I happened to win after I'd been playing just 3 months. And it was very encouraging to me at that early stage. And,
yeah, it should be.
You know, it was really cool that this just happened to be in the town I ended up going to for school. You know, I had no idea there was going to be a banjo contest. So like I said, you know, it seems like I fell into a life here. You know, I fell in with these musicians I'm still connected with, you know, this old time festival. Actually, it's coming up in a couple of weeks again. You know, I got a job in a bookstore. I'd been working in libraries, you know, I was learning to play the banjo better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, school, I'd been in school my whole life, and all of life is a school.
Right.
So yeah, like I said, grad school was good bait to get me to other things than grad school.
Yeah. What point were you writing songs? Did you start writing songs when you moved there, or were you playing other songs, or what were you doing at that point?
At that point, yeah, I was, when I first started banjo, so that was in August 2001, you know, I was learning old time songs, you know, those great initiation songs for old time music, and File Them Cabbage Down, you know, and Groundhog and Cripple Creek. And, you know, I was learning these old time banjo songs to basically just kind of get my right hand in shape with the claw, hammer, and learn chords and pick out melodies. So I'd just been doing that for a couple of months. But like I said, I'd always loved to write, and I had always loved music. And, you know, I'd been listening to folk music and traditional music and singer-songwriters my whole life. So, I mean, seriously, it was just a matter of months before I wrote my first song. It's actually on my first album. I still play it at shows. People still like it. I mean, of course, I think I play it a little bit more fancy than I did at first because my technique's gotten better. But yeah, it was just a matter of months before, like, hey, I can combine these parts into my own thing.
What song was it?
It's a song called The Good News. So it's on my first album, Nameless Heart. Another thing I joke, because I wrote some songs in that time really early on, I joke, but I'm serious, that writing songs has made me a better banjo player, because I have written songs that were beyond my ability to play them. I still do that, you know. I've written songs beyond my ability to play them and sing them, so it's forced me to become a better player and singer to be able to present my own songs. I mean, especially on my first album, there are some songs on there. I wrote the song somewhat a cappella, you know, recording it initially into a Radio Shack tape recording device, you know, before we all had voice memo on our phones. It was an a cappella thing, and then it took me a while to figure out how to put a banjo part under that and to be able to play the banjo part well enough. But good, you know, I'm in over my own head sometimes. I put myself in over my own head. But that's how I've learned a lot. Actually, that was a great thing about when I initially fell in with that old-time jam group. You know, I was in over my head. I'd just been playing a couple of weeks when I first started going. Thankfully, they were very welcoming. And, you know, I remember somebody pulling me aside, you know, just try to plunk out whatever note you can or record the jam sessions on my little, you know, tape recorder at that time and then go home and figure it out. And sure enough, you can learn more faster than you might think that way.
Right. Yeah. What inspires you to write a song?
Varying things. I mean, even this week, actually, speaking of voice memo, I mean, yesterday morning, I had a bit of a melody and a couple of lyrics in my head from a dream I had. I've had a couple songs where pieces of them have come to me in a dream, like a phrase, or I'll wake up and have a little bit of melody and, you know, try to capture it. Those feel like gifts in a way when I get those little gifts. Again, the thing I recorded yesterday morning, part of it, it's more of a rhythm and a melody. I'm going to need to sit down with that and craft and fill in these blanks where it's like, I've got a tune, but no words with them. So I've had some like that. Sometimes I'll have a phrase that'll come to me and I'll write it down because I'll feel like, oh, there's a song there. My album that just came out a few months ago, The Love Still Shows, I know the song Odds Are for Beating. I had that phrase come to me and I was like, oh, there's a song there. And I mean, I actually kind of lived with that phrase for quite some time before that song showed up, or even that first song I ended up writing on banjo, The Good News. I know this phrase came to me, you know, the good news is there's gold in the mud. Yeah. Okay, there's a song there, you know, yeah. Find out what it is. Some are more whimsical. I know the song Angel of the Cat on my album, The Love Still Shows, that just came out. It's a true story. And I basically fell in love with this neighborhood cat where I lived until recently. And I was like, I want to write a love song to the cat. You know? So it's all not always, you know, sometimes it's very profound and serious or sure coming from a dream, but, or this kind of phrase that has some sort of emotional weight with me. Well, I guess, you know, wanting to write a love song to the cat has emotional weight too, but a little bit more carefree and lighthearted, I guess.
Yeah. Cats need love too.
Hey, of course. Yeah.
So your style is traditional yet contemporary. I mean, that's kind of sounds like an oxymoron, but do you approach songwriting with that in mind? Do you want to keep a little bit of a traditional feeling to your songs when you write? Or are you like just wide open?
I'm fairly open. It's kind of funny because, I mean, to a lot of my friends or acquaintances who are very much traditionalists, you know, that they play traditional music, I'm kind of out there according to them. Whereas in the singer-songwriter communities I hang in, you know, that are often like guitar and piano based, I sound very traditional to them. But I don't know that it's something that I've tried to do. I think that's just kind of how it comes out for me. I mean, obviously I was steeped in a tradition somewhat. I mean, it's definitely got roots way back in my family on my mom's side. And I am from Virginia and I do play banjo and I do play clawhammer style at root, even though I make some innovations with that or improvisation to fit the song, you know, what serves the song that shows up or within my abilities, such as they are, you know, okay, how can I play this song? I think it's come about pretty naturally as opposed to something I've consciously like, hey, I'm trying to sound traditional, but write this contemporary song.
You're just writing from your heart.
How it's been.
Yeah,
it's just how it's been coming out so far.
That's the way it should be. You just always write from your heart. Yeah. We're also playing tracks from Nameless Heart, which was released in 2014. How was the experience of recording that album different from recording the newest one, The Love Still Shows?
I was a real newbie to the recording studio on my first one. I mean, I'd recorded some demos here and there and, you know, some friends, you know, garage studios or locally, but I had never made an album before. I mean, I'd been playing a good, I don't know, 12 years when I went into the studio for that one. So yeah, I mean, I guess since it was my first album, I learned a lot. I also learned a lot about the difference about getting a song across in a live performance versus getting a song across on a recording. Because, you know, say, you know, I sometimes would play in these coffee shops, which were relatively quiet and listening environments. But, you know, every once in a while, the blender would be going off you know, the latte machine.
Been there, done that.
Or, you know, there'd be some, you know, conversation by the cash register or maybe not the greatest sound setup. So to kind of get the song across and to connect with my audience where I would sing louder on parts to emphasize and whatnot. Whereas if I sang in the studio like that, it's like, wow, you know, it sounds like I'm yelling. So, okay, how's a way to get that emotion across, like singing more quietly and then maybe playing the banjo part stronger. Yeah. So there was that learning curve, which I guess is an ongoing process of performance for recording versus performance in a different type of venue or a live venue. There are multiple ways to communicate the same emotional effect in a song. And then my first album, I recorded in Austin, Texas at the Congress House studio with a gentleman named Mark Coleman. Actually, there's a documentary out about him that's going to be shown at the Far West Folk Alliance, The Shopkeeper, that my songwriter friend Rain Perry made. And she's the one who actually connected me with Mark to record there. So I packed up my car full of instruments and drove to Texas, and we recorded it in a week. And then he kind of mixed it and was sending me mixes, and I was giving him feedback by email and stuff afterward. So that was really good to get that born. You know, he's really encouraging. He really has a way of kind of putting musicians at ease and bringing out the best in people. It's a neat place. Like, it reminds me of my granny's house in Virginia, but it's a recording studio. That was a really great first experience to finally get that first album born. The second one, in contrast, I recorded in Southern California with Ed Tree at his studio down in San Gabriel. And I was seriously going down there for about a year and a half. I would say about 6 months when our schedules lined up, I'd go down there and be recording demos or kind of feeling out, okay, what songs fit together? What songs feel like album songs? How are we going to arrange these? I was able to take my time with it in a different way. You know, so 6 months of the demos and then kind of over the course of a year, recording it in earnest and mixing it in person. So, I mean, they were both valuable. I mean, there were kind of pros and cons to both approaches of, you know, recording in a week and working with what you got in a week. And then also pros and cons to like taking the time with it. I don't know if cons is the right word. I mean, there were advantages both ways or different challenges inherent in each situation. But yeah, they both had value and they were the both the right thing for the right time for how the album came about.
Right. Yeah, like the first one, when you've only got a week to record, how many songs was on there? 10, 11 songs?
There were actually 12. But 12. The thing is, you know, I had been playing and writing for 12 years, you know. So it was pretty clear. I already went in there knowing which ones feel like the album. And if we have time, maybe record a couple more. But, you know, I was more focused. But the thing is, like, I'd been playing for a long time. People had been asking for an album for me for a long time. I had been wanting to make an album for a long time, but I'd kind of had some false starts with people or leads that didn't pan out, or also in the course of the time I was writing the songs for Nameless Heart and performing that, you know, both my parents got very ill and died, you know, so, I mean, life happened.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of detours, you know, for whatever reason, it hadn't worked out to record it prior to the time it did. So I was like very ripe and ready. Like, okay, I have more than enough material.
You're like, let's get this done.
Strong enough. Yeah, let's get this thing born, you know?
Yeah, let's get this out of me.
Exactly. It's like, move on. It's overdue almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was overdue. I think sometimes when you have a longer time to work on something, like if you're working on it over a year, you can overthink it. At least that's my way of doing things. I overthink things and I overarrange it, or, you know, it's like, oh, let's do more here or whatever. But I don't think that you've done that with this album. It's got that minimalist feel to it, but it's really well made. I like the new
album.
Thank
you.
A lot. Yeah, it's a great song. Great song.
I appreciate that. Even though it was over a year, it wasn't like it was under the microscope for a whole year. I mean, part of it was by necessity. I mean, lucky for Ed Tree, he's very much in demand and has a very full schedule. And I mean, I had a very full schedule in life too. So part of the process was just like finding, okay, there's like 2 days this month where our white spaces on our schedule match up too. So it wasn't like it was under intense scrutiny at all times, which I think served it, you know, it kind of gave it time to evolve in its own way.
So I want to talk a little bit about Love Still Shows. The cover of the album is wonderful. Kind of describe it to our listeners and tell us what that picture is.
The cover photo is actually a photo of me on my first day of kindergarten. And I'm standing in front of the steps of the house I grew up in next to some red geraniums, which the title track, The Love Still Shows, the first half of that song is actually based on this photograph. I should also note, I have a construction paper school bus pinned to my dress in this picture to make sure I got on the right bus. Like, I could still use something like that. Where am I going? Where am I supposed to be?
If I'm not here, point me in the right direction.
You know, I had the revelation that I share in the song, you know, when I'm looking at this photograph years later, and then after the fact my parents have passed, I can still see the love they had for me that I almost didn't realize at the time, you know, that it was love. Like, I've got clean clothes on. Somebody combed my hair for school. They bothered to take a picture. And, you know, I didn't totally register that a lot growing up, that I took, I mean, not necessarily for granted. I mean, as a kid, but like I said, you know, there were a lot of kids in the house. There was some degree of chaos or feeling lost in the shuffle sometimes. But in hindsight, it's like, wow, you know, they did really love me the best they could and the way they could by taking care of me.
Yeah, that's a great way to think of it. I love that.
Thank you.
Another good song on the CD is Break Free, and it's doing really well in the charts. It's one of the songs I've seen on the charts the most. What do you think it is about that song that kind of resonates with listeners?
Well, in a way, it's such a, for me, an anthem of songwriting, but it's bigger than that. I mean, it's about the song that's our own lives. The refrain in it is, you know, there is a song inside of me longing to break free, or that by the end is breaking free. I've shared that at the beginning of songwriter gatherings. I mean, that it does tend to really resonate with songwriters, but I think there's something, at least in everybody that I talk to, my day work, I've worked in social services a long time, so I am graced with a lot of insight into people's lives because they open up to me and share with me as part of my job. And it seems like, you know, everybody has some part of life that they're longing to explore or express in a new way. So I think it kind of speaks to that universal longing, whether it's a literal song that you want to let out, or a literal creative project or process, or, you know, to me, the ultimate creative process is our lives. So.
Yeah. So another good song that I really like a lot is the song Beauty Queen. Is that song a true story?
Somewhat. I mean, it's an amalgam of a lot of things. I mean, songs have a way of being capital T true without necessarily being little t literally 100% true. But again, I mean, I think it speaks certainly to my own experience or the experience of a lot of friends of mine. I mean, I do have a lot of sisters or my mother, and even as a kid, I did witness them being down on themselves to a certain degree, or, you know, where I've been down on myself or how I look or don't fit up to some standard. Or one way it was sort of my visual art bug comes out now. I have this practice, I call it a sort of visual journal, but I make several collages a month, and I'll get like these recycled magazines a couple of places I go, or even my work, you know, people bring old magazines and after they've been there a while, like, okay, collage material. But, you know, a lot of these magazines and messages like lose weight, dress slimmer, what have you, it's kind of fun in the process of collages or in the song to take these sort of advertising messages and twist them to the opposite of what they're trying to say. Like, I always look forward to that magazine that's like, oh, those dark circles under your eyes add depth and mystery, or, you know, that's cellulite. It's texture, you know, that varicose vein, you know, it's like you've walked a lot of miles. You know?
Yeah.
They're sort of like reclaim these supposed flaws as positive. And I think it's rough. I mean, I've struggled with that self-image or being down on myself or seeing people I love be down on themselves. Or I'm having this kind of strange experience now. You know, my mom's been gone about 10 years. I'm not even the age she was when I was born. But it's like in the mirror, I'm reminded of my mom more and more because it's like I didn't think I resembled her as much as I do. But it's like, oh, wait, now I'm kind of becoming the age she was when I was growing up. I was like, oh, I do look more like my mom. And it kind of hurts my heart, you know, that she was kind of down on herself in a lot of ways. But I think it's also a cool challenge for me okay, if she was down on herself about these things, it's like, I don't have to be, and somehow redeem it for both of us.
Yeah. Were your parents older when they had you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I was a surprise. I mean, my mom thought I was menopause, right?
Oh, okay.
You know, she turned 45 a couple of weeks after I was born.
My mom was 43 when I was born, so.
You totally get it, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, I had that thing, which, I mean, in hindsight, I wonder how she felt, because people would always think she was my grandmother.
I got that, too.
Store or something. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you tell your granny, and it's like, it's my mom. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
And then also, I had this worry, too, for a while, you know, because I did kind of put together the dots at a young age that, wow, my parents are a lot older than most of my friends' parents at that time. And that means, you know, I might not have them as long, or like, oh, they might get sick, or I dealt with that. Or
oh, yeah, that fear.
I've worked in senior services for a long time, and I'm very comfortable in senior services. So in a way, I think my family situation, or just the fact that my parents were older, that I was very close to my granny who made it to 96, made me very comfortable with elders. Mm. It played out in my life in a variety of ways, you know.
Yeah, it's probably meant to be that way.
Exactly.
Another song we're playing on KCKV Radio is called It Ain't Personal. Can you tell us about that song?
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, that sometimes a phrase will stick with me, or, you know, will come to me and then will stick with me. And it's like, oh, there's a song there. So the phrase for that one that came to me when I was taking a walk one day was Fall from Grace, Grace Gonna Break My Fall. And actually, that was one of the really early songs I wrote when I first started writing songs as an a cappella piece. And it was sort of in its infancy. The first verse wasn't the same length as the second verse. You know, it's sort of a motley thing. I had an affection for this song because I would find myself singing it to myself to encourage myself. You know, fall from grace, grace gonna break my fall. Okay, even though I feel like I'm totally like bumbling, you know, I'm still going. Mm-hmm. Something's still sustaining me here. So when I was in that demo phase with Ed Tree starting this second album, I kind of brought out all kinds of odds and ends, and I was like, you know, here's this little odd misshapen song that I wrote years ago that in a way has like never felt finished to me, but also I've never been totally able to relegate it to the compost heap because it means something to me, or when I've shared it, I've gotten feedback that people have found it very encouraging. And so I played him the version of it, and he absolutely loved it, or the little banjo riff, and he's like, okay, your homework is finished that song. In the process of making this album, how the verses ended up the same length, I was thinking that I needed to kind of cut the longer, weird verse. And I was like, no, I need to make the first verse longer so that it matches the second one, and then kind of work out the arrangements. So it's funny, that song has its roots in probably back in 2003, when I first got that phrase and first wrote it as an a cappella piece. And then many years later, kind of working a banjo part for it, but it always kind of felt, like I said, unfinished. But then in the actual recording process, realizing like, okay, no, the song does want to have more of a life in the world, and time for this one to be finished. And
it's time for this one to be born.
Yeah, exactly. It was a slow gestation. You know, some of them come really quick and are finished quick, and some, I mean, seriously, that was, gosh, like a a 13-year song, granted with like long pauses in between. But
do you like to collect phrases and things? So I have like a book that you write phrases down in, and you'll go back to those and try to work songs out with them or something?
I do. I'd like to say it was really organized right now. I joke. I mean, well, I just moved 2.5 weeks ago, and it's like, God, how many partially filled notebooks can one woman?
Yes, exactly.
Because, I mean, I have a notebook in my purse, or I'll record voice memos or write things on a Post-it and shove it. And then, I mean, I love notebooks, and, you know, I'll start filling up a notebook, but then it'll kind of get misplaced, and then, oh, I have an idea, so then I grab another notebook. I will write down these ideas as they come to me, and sometimes, like, I'll probably sit down with that little song snippet that came to me yesterday morning and try to ask it, like, what are you anyway? I will consciously sit down with things, but sometimes these phrases, even when I write them down, some of them really kind of stick with me in my head and my body. Like, odds are for beating, odds are for beating. I mean, yes, I wrote that down, but it stuck with me in my life and was helpful. Or fall from grace, grace gonna break my fall, which was sort of the seed for It Ain't Personal. That really stuck with me. It was like the virtual Post-it note.
Yeah.
In addition to the literal one in my notebook somewhere.
Right. Yeah. So you live your songs, or you try to put them in your own personal lexicon anyway.
Yeah. Or they tend to be, I mean, obviously if something moves me or moves me enough to write it, a lot of these, I mean, I guess I somewhat selfishly, like, I write them for myself. Like, it's like, well, I need to hear this song. If nobody else in the world needs to hear the song, well, maybe I do, you know?
Right.
I mean, if this phrase keeps coming to me to encourage me or moves me in some way. And then at least the feedback I've gotten, the cool added bonus is some of those things that I found moving to me or encouraging to me work for other people too. So
yeah.
Bonus.
Exactly. Yeah. For, you know, one of the reasons I think I like to perform now anyway is it's very cathartic for me. If there's something going on in the world, you know, and I've got a song that I know that's going to speak to that, I'll sing it just so I can sing it and get it out there and out of my system. That's a great thing about songwriting and performing, is it can be a cathartic release for you.
Exactly.
Are you touring with this CD?
I haven't. I've been playing shows here and there throughout the region. I joke, you know, I play when and where asked for the most part. Like I said, I just moved a couple of weeks ago. I had some unexpected housing upheaval, but that's worked out for the best. That kind of put a change in some of my plans right now. But the next show that I know of I have coming up is in October up in Ojai with my friend Rain Perry, who I mentioned. We'll share a show up there. And then I've got some other things in the works, but until they're all confirmed.
What type of venues do you usually perform at?
I tend to play a lot in various kind of art spaces, which I actually like a lot because they tend to be listening environments. They think just the nature of what I do is suited to, you know, a sit-down listening audience. I did my CD release show a couple months ago at a performing art space in town, or this place I'm playing in Ojai. It's called the Ojai Arts Exchange, and they have what they call the Underground Exchange at night, where they have performances. You know, different sorts of art galleries, art studios, things like that. And it's funny. Well, like I said, you know, my background is in visual art. So the meeting of the world, I mean, it might have to do with it. I feel comfortable in those spaces, but it tends to be audiences, you know, sit down listening audience who appreciate it and resonate with what I do. So.
So do you ever like do your art with your music? Do you have your visuals as well as your music together in any place?
Well, the cover of Nameless Heart, my first album, there's an image of a heart over sort of deep space Hubble telescope imagery with an open door in it. That was actually based on a piece of artwork I did that got Doherty, the graphic designer, you know, that I had work up in this graphic format. So I definitely had a design hand in the albums. And then actually some of the songs, Break Free, which is a song we talked about, I know I made a collage when I was working on that song because I had a couple places like I can feel the missing word very close in proximity to me and I can't figure out like what word goes in this line. So often when I'm working on songs, I'm also working on collages and sometimes they've helped clarify, you know, oh, that's what goes in that line. So they do sort of cross-pollinate each other in a way.
Are there any other projects you're working on, or you've started working on the next album? Are you like looking at working on any other things in the near future?
Well, right now I'm getting back to writing again more in earnest. So I don't know in this day and age how much sense it makes anymore to put out a physical CD, but we'll see. I'm one of those people, like, I have to be creating something for my own sake and well-being, and therefore I'm more of a delight to be around if I'm working on some sort of creative project. So that's a given. If I'm alive, you know, I need to be kind of working on some kind of creation. So I guess kind of keep working on songs and see if maybe some of these songs that I have that I haven't recorded yet or that I'm working on, if eventually they feel like an album or perhaps some sort of digital release. You know, I trust I'll know right on time when I need to know. But right now my work is to just keep on writing and keep on playing.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, we're glad that you are writing and playing. Donalyn Caskey's new CD is called The Love Still Shows. And it's available at CD Baby, also on iTunes and Amazon, but you can always go to the website, DonalynCaskey.com. That's spelled C-A-S-K-E-Y, Caskey. Go to there and pick up the CD, and you can also find out more about Donna and her music. I think you've got a couple of YouTube videos up as well that people could check out and kind of see what the clawhammer-style banjo is and why she's called the banjo gal. Well, Donna, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today on KC Cafe Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kathy.